It's another Sunday afternoon and time once again for Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. Today we're going to do something. We're going to look back about 6 months to a show that we did with translator Nan Watkins, who's working on the last book of the Alsatian surrealist poet Ivan Gaal. Nan, read us a little bit of Gaal's work.
This is a poem called 10,000 Dawns. 10,000 dawns, my angel, 10,000 dawns. 10,000 times the eye of the sun has come to open again our eyelids. 10,000 dawns for this one night of our love. Your head sculpted in my arms, the rose garden of your hair on fire with 10,000 red roses. Oh, what fireworks! And the 10,000 voices of waves. How many moons have passed, delirious or sad, covering us with the ecstasy of snow. And of old men who have lent us their eyes, and of children who have eaten our hearts in the 10,000 dreams of love. 10,000 dawns, my angel, 10,000 dawns. 10,000 eggs filled with birds and their songs. 10,000 sun yolks, more than make up for this death of 100,000 stars.
Fabulous stuff. It's almost impossible to talk about Ivan without talking about Claire as well. So I know 10,000 Dawns in particular, they authored together, essentially. It was a dialogue. They knew each other and lived together for 10,000 dawns. And it's a fabulous book. This is available. It's translated by Nan Watkins and Thomas Raincrow, Ivan Gaal's 10,000 Dawns. I guess it's still in print. So
yes, it is.
It's White
Pine Press
White
up
Pine
in
Press.
Buffalo.
Right, right. Wonderful little edition. How did you come to be involved with Gaal's work?
Well, it was actually through Thomas, who had found a Thomas Crow,
right,
who had found a volume of Ivan's poems translated into English on the shelf of John Lane, who is a poet and writer in Spartanburg.
Right, right.
And he borrowed the book and brought it home, and we read it. And I was working in the library at Western Carolina at the time and ran to look up who this man was, because mm-hmm. we really didn't understand the background.
Mm-hmm.
And without too much trouble, I discovered that he had written a very large volume of work, that he had married Claire, mm-hmm. and the two had had a very dynamic and, you could even say, stormy relationship.
Indeed.
For many years. And the
right.
poem that we began with was one that he wrote to honor the 30th anniversary of the day that they met. And they met on February 10th, 1917, in Switzerland.
Huh.
And so this poem was written on February 10th, 1947,
uh-huh.
when they were living in New York City. And I've actually visited the place where they lived, on the river, East River in Brooklyn,
uh-huh.
on Columbia Heights in Brooklyn. And he shoved that poem, 10,000 Dawns, honoring their 30 years together, uh-huh. under Claire's door on the morning of that anniversary, February 10th. So
nice.
It's a nice story.
Very sweet. Very
yes.
sweet. Yeah. Well, I know Thomas, of course, has been interested in the surrealist for, since he was in his 20s, at
yes.
least.
Oh, indeed.
So I'm interested to hear that he didn't discover Gaal. I mean, I didn't discover Gaal either. The only Gaal I knew up until 10,000 Dawns was Galway Kinnell's translation of Lackawanna Elegy.
That's right.
Which came out back in the 70s.
Yes.
And I was floored by that. I mean, it's so clear that Gaal is just a major poet.
Right, and that's a beautiful translation
that
Galway Kinnell did.
Yeah, lovely piece of work.
And Lackawanna Elegy shows Ivan's honor and romance, I almost want to say, with the American Indian. He was fascinated with the people who lived here before the Europeans colonized the country. Mm-hmm. And that's not the only piece that he wrote honoring Indians. And where he lived, right on the cusp of the river there, I believe he was fascinated with the Manahatta Indians on Manhattan Island, and the Ifathonga and so on. And he loved the music of the words of the names of these people. And he went up into Canada and also looked into that. So it was wonderful that Galway was able to translate that Lackawanna elegy. And he did it with the encouragement of Clare after Yvonne had died. Yeah. Yvonne died in 1950.
Right.
So, and Galway Connell knew Clare Gall.
Uh-huh.
And she was
lived for quite a while after Yvonne had died.
That's right. He died in 1950, and she lived on till 1977.
Right.
So, and she spent a major portion of her energy in those years promoting Yvonne's work.
Mm-hmm.
And when she met Galway Connell and Robert Bly, she encouraged both of them to translate her husband's work, and they have done that.
Mm-hmm.
And Galway Connell did a full book, Lackawanna Elegy, whereas Robert Bly has done individual poems that appeared in selected poems.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, read us another one. Shall we talk about 10,000 Dawns?
Well, we could. We could.
Yeah.
10,000 Dawns. Well, let's go back just a little bit and say something about how Gall got started. He was born in Alsace in 1891, and the years of his work, of his real writing, were from around 1920 to 1950. So he had 30 very productive years writing and translating and just being very, very active with artistic circles wherever he lived.
Mm-hmm. And because he was born in Alsace, he was bilingual.
That's right.
He spoke both German and French fluently.
That's right.
Natively, one should say.
That's exactly right. Yeah. His parents spoke French in the home. And as soon as he went to school, at the time, Alsace was under German control.
Right.
So all of the schools were in German.
Uh-huh.
So all of the children were in this mixture of languages of French and German.
Mm-hmm.
And Yvonne's father died when he was very young, and he moved with his mother into Metz and went to all of the schooling there in German, and then went on to Strasbourg. And as he became older in 1914 and the war broke out, the First World War, he wanted to declare himself a pacifist. In fact, he did, and he left immediately for Switzerland so that he would not be drafted into the German Reich Army.
Right.
And that was a key point because Clare, also, who would become his wife later, was a pacifist, and she had been in Switzerland. And she read a poem that he wrote about the fallen of Europe, the fallen soldiers of Europe. And when she read the poem, she just was instinctively attracted to this man. And she writes a story about it, saying that she imagined he would be an older, bearded person because it had such wisdom about the sadness of war and the futility of war. And so she decided to look him up.
Hmm.
And when she went to see him and somebody pointed him out in the room, here was this handsome young man.
Right.
And she was just stunned. And so she introduced herself, and it was, as they say, love at first sight.
Yeah.
And they were just inseparable from the beginning.
Uh-huh.
And she herself had a career, or has really a full career too.
Mm-hmm.
And she had shown her first volume of poetry to Rilke.
Right.
And had gone up to Munich because he had said, I would like to meet you. Please come to meet. And there's another amusing story about that. She didn't stay terribly long because she got impatient with the fact that there was a whole line of women waiting to meet Rilke in Munich at the time. So she went
popular
back.
Guy.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So she went back to Switzerland and made a very clear commitment to Yvonne.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even though she stayed friends with Rilke to the end of his life.
Yeah.
And there's a little book about that, their correspondence.
Uh-huh.
And that's never been translated either. There's all sorts of things.
Another project.
Right. You bet.
Well, do we have any of Yvonne's early work?
In terms of poetry, I might say that he also did many, many other things besides the poetry. He wrote, one of his early pieces was a play called Methusalem, and that is still in print in a New Directions collection of plays. It was a satire on the bourgeoisie, and he went up to Berlin in, I believe it was 1924, for the first performance of that. So in his, that was one of the very early pieces, and it made him somewhat famous at the time because he had the nerve to speak out and really make a satirical statement on the bourgeois life after the war in Berlin. And I don't have that translation here with me now, but it's a standard that if people are looking into European drama, that is definitely one. And he influenced a lot of other theater dramatists through that play and others that he had written.
Does most of his early work survive in some form?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
Right.
He was a prolific letter writer. He worked together with Kurt Weill on two musical pieces.
Really?
One is called, the original title is called Royal Palace. It's not written, even though the text is in German, Yvonne wrote the lyrics for it. It's a one-act opera. And then he also wrote the lyrics, I guess we call it, for a cantata that Kurt Weill did. So he was a collaborator with all kinds of people all along the way, from the very early days like that, all through to the very end, and with artists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Chagall, Picasso.
Right. Because he founded, he had several publishing houses, publishing companies that when he was living in Paris and then later when he was living in New York. And he loved beautiful books. And whenever he published something, he enlisted the talents of his friends and Marc Chagall. For instance, Marc Chagall has made 8 drawings that appear in the 10,000 Dawns volume that Thomas and I translated. And they're wonderful, almost whimsical, and drawings of Yvonne and Claire. And the Chagalls were in exile in New York at the same time as Claire and Yvonne, and so they remained friends in Brooklyn as well. When I was searching for the rights to publish this book, I went to the museum in Brooklyn, and that's how I first got the permission to get the Chagall and the Gall together.
Great. We're listening to an interview with poet and translator Nan Watkins, parts of which were included in a Wordplay show back in December of last year, when Wordplay, of course, was only a 30-minute show. We're now getting the benefit of hearing the whole thing. Let's hear some more. You know, we haven't talked yet much about Traumkraut, which is your current project.
Right.
And we should do that. We should talk about Traumkraut.
All right.
Because this is his last work. He came down with leukemia.
Yes. It was one of those things, I think, in a sense, you have to say, terribly bad timing in his life, because first he, you know, lives through the two world wars and the Depression, and in the summer of 1945, just when you might think that life was beginning to look bright for him, he was diagnosed with leukemia and told that it was a death sentence.
Was he still in New York?
He was still in New York. Mm-hmm. It was New York doctors that diagnosed that. And he managed to stay on another year and a half or so. And then the disease was making him very weak. And so he and Claire took a boat back to Paris, and he went almost immediately into the hospital in Strasbourg. Hmm. And that was where he had been a student years ago. So it was as if he was returning on some level to his native ground. And it was there in Strasbourg, in the hospital, that he began writing these poems of anguish about the death that he had to face. And I think all of the imagery that he had seen in the wars had to have influenced his idea of his own death. Mm-hmm. And Galway points out that death was a familiar to him from the beginning because of the time period when he was living and where he was living. So after he died, he died in 1950, and Claire put together the volume that he was working on. But very early on, he had a name for that. Mm-hmm. And it's, again, a made-up word in German. It's called Traumkraut. And if you speak German, it's an interesting word because you say, what on earth can that mean? But the translation I'm using is dream weed.
Dream weed, as opposed to dream grass.
Yes.
Right.
Some people have said dream grass. But when you read the entire volume and look at it, he refers over and over again to a flower or a weed that has come to him. It is a very symbolic of his end and the darkness of his life. And I have wrestled with that title, but I'm going to stay with that for a while, unless I would end up with a publisher who would insist on something else. But when he was out of the hospital in Strasbourg, then he went back to Paris and decided that he was going to try to have a few of those poems that he was working on published. Mm-hmm. And the significant thing is that he had been writing poetry only in French for the last 20 years. Hmm. One possible reason for this may have been that he was on the blacklist in Germany because of being Jewish. And they had actually revoked his German citizenship in 1933, I think it was.
Uh-huh. Right after the Nazis came to power.
Yes, so that he was unable to publish his work in German. They wouldn't publish it.
Yeah.
So at that point, he was
trying... The same time they were driving Kandinsky out of Germany and shutting down the Bauhaus.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yes.
And so he was then translating some of the things that he had written originally in German into French just to get them published in Paris. Hmm. But when he was feeling this agony of his impending death, the only way he could conceive it was in German.
Mm-hmm.
So that's significant in the life of Ivan that he writes this. And he decides to write to an editor of a journal called Das Goldene Tor, which is the Golden Gate. And his name was Alfred Döblin. And he sends him five poems and says, I am writing these poems in German, and I feel, oddly, a new lease on life because I'm able to write in German, and I'm returning belatedly. Of course, he's referring to leaving the exile, coming back to Europe, and he's wondering if this man sees anything in these poems. And he says, this strange Traumkraut, this dream weed, is illuminating my life in a way that it's never been shown to me before. And here are some poems. And Döblin looks at them and publishes all five of them immediately.
Hmm.
So that was the beginning. He actually called it Das Traumkraut. The puts in the article there.
Right.
But so he continues to write this and had his versions of the poem in a folder, a little blue folder that he had with him to the very end when he was dying in the American hospital in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow or other, after his death, that little blue volume, that little blue folder, with his final versions was missing. And I'm not certain if it's been found right now, and I haven't been able to see that. But the only thing, reason that that's significant is because the book was actually published after he died.
Right.
And it was his wife, Claire, who edited the book. So you say to yourself, the final version had also gone through her, and the second half of the book was love poems to her. Because the one time when he seemed truly happy and had could see the beauty in life was when he was writing love poems.
Sure.
Otherwise, he was writing these terrible moments of his great pain and suffering when he was dying.
Right.
So the book has this combination of the great sadness, the agony of his life in the beginning, and then a series of love poems at the end where he's trying to reconcile the whole business of life and death.
Right. Well, could you read us a few of those?
Well, yes, I think
you could do that?
Yes, several of them are appearing in the latest issue of the of the Asheville Poetry Review. So I'm very excited about that.
Great.
And let me start with one called "This Holy Body," because it gives you a sense of his disease, his sense of wondering what is he doing in this body at this time. "This Holy Body" by Yvonne Gall. "This shaky house of bones built upon sand, lodging for my ancestors. From my eyes they follow all the roads I take. My spleen is their kitchen where they cook with fat and blood. In the niche of the ruins, my mother still sleeps. Old men's tobacco smoke clings to her larynx. My holy body. Sacrificial animals roar deep within me, and beef loins exhale their stench every Saturday. My mouth still houses century-old magic. In my ears, I hear a ringing and no God."
Zowie.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's a man who's struggling.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking.
Very aware of the precipice.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's see. Let's read another one from this early part before we get into the poems, the love poems.
The love poems, yes.
I will read a poem that is somewhat of a mystery and has fascinated quite a few people, not only other poets, but musicians. I've found that several musicians have actually set this to music, and it's like there's a mystery here, and everyone's fascinated by it. But it's the one poem in the whole book that uses the word dreamweed or traumkraut. So we'll use it. And the poem is called Alasam, and it's a word that, again, is a Gaul word.
Right.
And but if you hear it in context, you'll have to make up your own idea of what it is. Alasam, the unshed tear in the hollow of my skull. From this, there grew long, long generations later, a dream weed, night yellow, murder sallow, unique flower, unnoticed by the bees. So, in the fall, I was out in the garden with Thomas, helping to pull up some weeds and things, and I came across nightshade. And I was pulling it up, and I was saying to myself, this is Gaul's traumkraut. I just said it. And then, of course, I look back, and it says, night yellow, murder sallow. You can die if you, you know, drink, eat, right. the nightshade. And I was just wondering if, this is just strictly me, I have no idea if there's any foundation behind it, if nightshade could have been an inspiration for his Traum Kraut, for his dream weed. But this is the flower that he wrote to that editor back in Paris, saying, this has given me a new lease on my life, that I see this flower, that it's with me, it's in my dream, my dream flower.
Right, yeah.
And then there are other places where we get references to a dream weed type thing. Just to give we can either do more.
Let's do one or two more. Yeah.
Bad body poems, or I mean, where he's having a hard time with the body, or should we do a...
Let's do one more of those, and then we'll switch to the later section of the book.
Right.
Yes.
All right. This one we can call Bloodhound, and that's a piece that is very strong here.
Okay.
Bloodhound at my heart, who guards my fire, who feeds on bitter kidneys in the suburb of my misery. With the wet flame of your tongue, lick the salt of my sweat, sugar of my death. Bloodhound in my flesh, retrieve the dreams that fly away from me. Bark at the white ghosts, bring all my gazelles back to their fold, and bite the ankles of my runaway angel.
Bite the ankles of my runaway angel.
Right.
Nice.
In other words, his angel is no longer there to protect him, and he's just
gone.
Yes.
Run away.
He's completely run away about the whole thing.
Yeah.
There is a story also about the writing of these poems that I don't want to forget to mention.
Uh-huh.
And Claire tells about it in her introduction to it, and that is that when Gall lay dying in his final days in the American hospital in Paris, the poets lined up in droves to donate blood for him. So he had such a series of friendships and people who just were so very sad to think that they would lose his great talent just when he was returning from exile.
Right.
And he was not yet 60 years old, so it wasn't as if he was really an old man. And I have tried very hard to find out who some of these poets were, because she mentions they come from many countries, Norway and France and Switzerland and Germany, and she says a number of young Americans.
Uh-huh.
And so I've been trying to find out, but that's still a quest
I'm
on.
Right.
I haven't figured it out.
Uh-huh.
But here's a beautiful one that he wrote in his very last days, and it's to Claire, and it's a classic, Yvonne Gall. It was written in the American hospital in Paris within the month before he died.
Wow.
Did I pluck you in the gardens of Ephesus? The curly hair of your carnations, the evening bouquet of your hands? Did I fish for you in the lakes of dream? An angler on your meadow shores, I threw you my heart for food. Did I find you in the dryness of the desert? You were my last tree. You were the last fruit of my soul. Now I am wrapped in your sleep, bedded deep in your repose, like the almond in its night brown shell.
Lovely. Yeah.
That's a beautiful piece.
Fascinating work. This is WPVM 103.5, the progressive voice of the mountains in Asheville, North Carolina. You're tuned to Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis, and we're listening today to an interview with translator Nan Watkins, part of which was featured on a Wordplay show in December of last year, when, of course, Wordplay was only a 30-minute show. Now for some more. How did you work? How did you approach it?
Wow, that's the essential question for any translator any time throughout history, really. A translator has to have a point of view or a strategy, I would say, on how he or she wants to approach the work that he's doing. Mm-hmm. I like to think of translation as the ultimate wordplay, really. It's the art of communication, and it's taking someone's spoken word or written word, and that was part of one very specific culture in our world of Babel, where we live, or Babel, and trying to pick that up and transfer it into another culture and another language. And this poses huge problems for
all the context may be different.
That's right.
For given statements.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there have been hundreds, hundreds of books and articles written on this over the years. And of course, thousands of works are translated. And I, for one, am very happy to see that the American audiences are reading far more translations now. If you look at lists of books, or the New York Times list this year of the top 100 books that they found, there were many translations on there, and I'm just saying hip hip hooray for the art of translation.
Right.
But again, one of my favorite people who has been an inspiration to me as a translator is Gregory Rabassa, and he does not translate German, of course.
Garcia Marquez, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah. And he, Marquez, has an absolutely wonderful quote on Rabassa's memoir as being a translator. And he says, he is the best Latin American writer in the English language. Rabassa is. And Rabassa called his memoir, If This Be Treason. And he's taking that word treason from an Italian saying, which is, and bear in mind I don't speak Italian, but it's traduttore traditore. Mm-hmm. And if you translate that, it's translator traitor.
Traitor, right.
Of course. Mm-hmm. And anybody who's been in translation realizes that there is a certain...
A germ of truth.
...aspect of the traitor in trying to lift this whole work, whatever it is, whether it's prose or poetry, or even if it's a very factual thing or somebody's speech, and move it along. And it's just... a lot of choices that a translator has to make along the way. And there are a lot of nuggets of good advice that Rabassa gives in his little memoir. And one that I like is, be careful not to nail your translation onto the period in which you are living.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that addresses the fact that you can often look at a work and see that the work itself is timeless. The original work is timeless. Mm-hmm. But when you go back and look at translations, they seem to be not timeless. They are hooked.
Mm-hmm.
They are, you know, just as he says, nailed to the time period.
Yeah, to their own era.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so then times change. Someone else comes along and says, wow, this is an outdated a translation. I need to redo this.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we have many, many translations of a lot of the classic works.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And another thing he says, in a classic, use evergreen words.
Mm-hmm. And evergreen words.
And isn't that a nice way putting it?
Yeah, indeed.
So for Gaul, when I started to do Gaul, I had to plan my own particular strategy. And I had to decide, did I want to be a real literalist and try to make it as close to as possible, or you know, you make lots of decisions. What kind of language do you want to use? Do you want it to be very formal? Do you want to try to imitate or reproduce or recreate, is a better word than imitate, recreate the same style or the same thought processes that Gaul had in his mind. Mm-hmm. And of course, he was writing in the first half of the 20th century, and now I'm translating in the very beginning of the 21st century.
Right.
So there's a difference in time. and I have to figure it out. And one guidepost for me in my thinking is sometimes to imagine how would Gall have written his poem if he were writing it originally in English. Mm-hmm. And I try to get myself into his mindset, his place, go back. And then that means that you aren't quite as likely to fall into a terribly academic translation on the one hand or an overly folksy one on the other hand. You have to think of the tone that you want to use. Look at the work as a whole and go back and say, I think, for instance, when Gall was doing this work and he's really near death, he's in a state of great suffering, I think he hearkened back a lot to some of the Old Testament language. Mm-hmm. And there were certain poems, like one Job, mm-hmm. That to me echoes passages in the book of Job. Mm-hmm. And I could, in fact, when I began, I was translating it in what would be more or less common language today. Uh-huh. But as I came back and read it over and over, I would hear echoes of the old original Job. Mm-hmm. And so my version at the moment is closer to an Old Testament sound in just a few of those verses. That's just in that particular mm-hmm. poem.
King James or Revised Standard? Or some other version?
A little closer to King James. But mm-hmm. the Bible, of course, is a perfect example mm-hmm. of translation.
Right.
And it makes you realize that if you look at the difference between King James or the Good News Bible or the Revised Standard or any number of others that have been mm-hmm. put out by different groups within the Christian churches, you sometimes wonder if they were all reading the same text.
Right, indeed.
Because it's so different. So mm-hmm. it just shows you the example of the difference. And a few little things, if you wanted to be specific of problems that translators run into, is things like idioms. If you have an idiom in language, how do you translate that mm-hmm. into the other? It may be, you know, utter nonsense.
Right. There may be a corresponding idiom, right. But there may not be.
And there may not be. Right. And then you just try to figure it out, you know, or humor or jokes or wordplay,
right.
You know, when
puns are
terrifically
hard.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes. So you have to figure out, are you going to try to reproduce this? And just get the tone of the thing. And mm-hmm. I think that's very important to mm-hmm. try to do it. My favorite way of seeing a translation published is to have it bilingual.
Yes.
With the original.
Facing
right. The original is on the left and your translation is on the right. And then that allows your reader the chance to go back and say, gosh, I wouldn't have done it that way, or why did she do it like this, or oh wow, she mm-hmm. really got it right there.
Right.
And it allows the reader of the English to be much more active mm-hmm. and engaged mm-hmm. in reading the translation, I think.
Yeah, I prefer my translations like that as well.
Yeah. Well, that would be the ultimate for me, to be able to have this Book of Traumkraut, mm-hmm. the last work of Gall, published in a bilingual mm-hmm. version.
Right.
But we'll just have to wait and see.
Right. Well, let's bring this down to like one specific poem in Traumkraut. Let's look at some of the difficulties you faced in one particular piece of this last book.
Well, there's a lot of different places that I had to make choices all the way through. Did you want to talk about some of the problems with the German language of compound nouns?
Oh, yes.
That you can do things
right.
there.
You can do things in German
that you can
in English look really, really goofy.
right. There was one. It's called The Blast Furnaces of Pain, which was one of his really strong poems in the beginning, where he's just rebelling against the suffering of his mm-hmm. disease of leukemia. And he ends it on the final line. He uses the word Totensonne, which is like It uses the word dead or death and son. Mm-hmm. And in the context, it's very difficult to understand what he's really talking about. Is it the son of our dead or our son of the dead? And we're not sure. Mm-hmm. So we're working on that. But it's also you'd have to say several words in English to get around this one idea of a Totenzana that he has for that. I don't know. Is it worth reading that in the German?
Let's hear that one in German.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This is one of the earlier poems in the book. In den Hochöfen des Schmerzes, welches Erz wird da geschmolzen, die Eiterknechte, die Fieberschwestern wissen es nicht. Tagsschicht, Nachtschicht allen Fleisches blühen die Wunden und die Feuer wild in den Salpetergärten und den heißen Roseneckern. Asphodel in meiner Angst an den Abhängen der Nacht. Ach, was braut der Herr der Erde in den Herzen, den Schrei, den Menschenschrei aus dunklem Leib, der wie ein geweihter Dolch unsere Totensonne schlitzt. Hmm. It's almost a tongue twister, some of that German in there. It's you could hear my tongue trying to get around some of those words.
Yeah.
But it's a very, very strong poem full of different images. Just I'll give a quick translation of it now. In the blast furnaces of pain, what ore is smelted there? The servants of pus, the nurses of fever, they have no answer. Day shift, night shift of all flesh, the wounds and the fires bloom wild in gardens of saltpeter and burning fields of roses. Asphodels of my fear on the cliffs of night. What does the Lord of Ores brew in our hearts? The cry, the human cry from the dark body that like a consecrated dagger slashes our son of the dead.
Mm.
And so we're working with that and hoping that the imagery is something close to what Gall was thinking when he was writing this piece.
Very compelling in English. Yes.
I hope so. That's another. German, of course, is a Germanic language, and English is too. Mm-hmm. But English is filled with so many words that derive from the Latin that I find when I'm making my choices, I will inevitably go to a Germanic root word rather than the Latin. And not every single time, of course, because in English that would get very stark.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to be closer to the German, just logically speaking.
Yeah.
You know, many times the words are very directly
etymologically
related.
Etymologically, it's... Right. Yeah.
Right.
Very much closer.
Right. So so that's another thing that translators consider is what was the source language?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, for me, the source was German. And what is the target language?
Yeah.
And how are they related or how are they unrelated?
Right.
And that's another basis for making decisions and choices of individual words and how you're going to approach it.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. When I was doing this, I sat down, and of course, I read the entire manuscript in German first, and then just sat down, literally at the computer, I have to admit, and began typing in just the quickest possible translation that I could do.
Uh-huh.
And if I got stuck on certain words, I didn't even look up a dictionary.
Wow.
I would maybe leave it blank or make up something just to get the sweep of the whole manuscript together and get a feel of how these things hung together.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back and started the tedious process of revising. But I think you get a certain energy from that first time that's like a hunch. Rabassa talks about that translators should use their hunches and even just let the critics carp all they will. If it feels really right and isn't an exact duplicate translation of the word, go with it. Go with your hunch.
Yeah. Better to do that.
Right. So that's what I've tried to do, too.
Well, neat. I think it's worked really well, of course.
Yeah. Have you done any translating at all?
Only some from French, from Rene Char's work. And Paul Verlaine early on.
Wow.
Worked on his stuff. But that's the limit of my experience.
Did you have any special problems that you remember? I mean, going from the French to the English?
In the case of Char's work, yes, because Char is another surrealist.
Right.
And is inventing new vocabulary as he goes often, or using vocabulary in unusual, unorthodox ways. Mm-hmm. It was a challenge. It was fun.
It's a challenge, but it does allow you a certain freedom, too, to do the same in your translation.
It does.
One thing in this discussion of translating Gaul, we shouldn't forget that he himself was a master translator.
Exactly. I mean, and, translating even Joyce, for instance.
Yes. And was able to go from German to French and French to German because he was so bilingual right from the beginning. But interestingly enough, if you look up his work in a wonderful full bibliography of all of the primary works that he wrote, you'll find that one of the first publications he ever did was a translation of Walt Whitman from the English.
Really?
And he got together with another man, the other translator published some of Whitman's poems, and Gall translated some of Whitman's notes that he had written when he was a nurse during the Civil War.
Right.
And this was published in 1917, 1918. So you see, there was Gaul in the midst of this
Holocaust.
Horrible thing.
That was a different sort of Holocaust than occurred in World War II. But
I mean, we could say truthfully any war is a Holocaust.
Right. Indeed.
And
World War I was especially awful given the trench warfare.
And he was a pacifist.
Right.
And so here he was, and he had left his native country, was in Switzerland, because it was the neutral place where he could remain.
Right.
So he acted to write as much as he could of his own work and find other works to bring to the fore anti-war writing. Mm-hmm. And he was attracted to Whitman, which I'm very impressed by, because here he is later in his life during the next Holocaust of World War II, living in Brooklyn where Whitman lived.
Right, that's true. Yeah.
So when he was 27 years old, he had already translated some of Whitman's Civil War notes.
Yeah, fascinating.
It is.
Did he ever do any of Leaves of Grass, so far as you know?
Not that I recall. Yeah. I don't think he did.
Right.
But I was going back over some of his work, and of course, if you look at Leaves of Grass, one of the poems is Manahatta.
Yes.
And that was something that fascinated Gaul no end. Mm-hmm. These stories of the Aboriginal settlers there in Brooklyn on the East River.
Huh.
So there was this link, I think, with Whitman from the beginning right to the end of his life.
Very interesting. Very interesting indeed. Thank you. So if people were going out to look for Gall's work now in its original publications, would they find it now all listed under Ivan Gall and under his name? I know he used various heteronyms.
Yes, he did.
Yes, 15 different heteronyms.
Yes, he did. And he had the habit of spelling his first name in different ways. If he was publishing in France, it was Y-V-A-N, uh-huh. Ivan. Uh-huh. If he was in the United States, it was I-V-A-N, uh-huh. as Ivan. Uh-huh. And if he was in Germany, it was I-W-A-N. So it can be a bit of a pain in the neck on the computer, which tends to be literal.
Right.
You have to, if you're really trying to find something that he published under the name of Gall, you have to type in the three different first
versions
spellings
of the first name. Right. And what were some of the other names that he used?
In the very beginning, he began with his mother's maiden name, Lassang, uh-huh. and then he played around with that. And his original name, His birth name was Isaac Lang, just uh-huh. L-A-N-G, huh. and he never, to my knowledge, ever used that as an author, as uh-huh. as a poet. And I don't know why. I'm still going through all sorts of letters and piece notes and things that he's written in his life, trying to find out more of his backgrounds, but I have many questions, and that's one. Uh-huh. What made him never use his birth name in his writing?
Hmm. Though, let's see, other surrealists also wrote under heteronyms.
Oh, yes.
I mean, it was fairly common practice.
Many poets through the ages have used. In fact, the old Celts would have their poetic name. They would leave behind their Johnny Smith or whoever they were and take some exalted name to be known that way as a poet. So uh-huh. I think he must be in that tradition uh-huh. where he wanted. But it took him a long time to settle on Ivan Gall, and uh-huh. then when he did, he never settled on the final spelling.
He still varied it.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Right. Which is interesting. Maybe because he was so bilingual, or even to an extent trilingual himself, mm-hmm. he was conscious of that and wanted to fit in, mm-hmm. perhaps, in each culture. I don't know.
Yeah. Curious. Yeah.
Right.
Well, Nan, why don't you read us another of your translations?
Okay. I think we mentioned a little before that three of these translations have appeared in the most
New
recent
National Poetry Review.
Yes, and I was really so happy to do that. Keith Flynn's wonderful to take on this and be the first one to have any of these Traumkraut poems published in English. So there's one that he took, and it doesn't actually have a title. We just use the first line, so I'll go right into it.
Okay.
I was the seeker, and you the sorceress on the three-legged stool of time. I brought you my totem as sacrifice. In return, you gave me the smoke of memory. It was a stag etched into your forehead. From your green glens, I perceived a song never heard before. Why did I descend into your volcanoes? I have long since forgotten what I was seeking. Was it love or understanding?
Mm-hmm. Very nice.
And
that
shows a little bit of the dynamic that must have occurred between Yvonne and Claire.
And Claire.
But for instance, in that first verse, the German is, Ich war der Fragende und du die Magierin auf dem Dreistuhl der Zeit. And if you take the German word Dreistuhl, it's literally a tripod.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine this sorceress sitting on a tripod.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work for me in English. So I've made it into a three-legged stool.
Hmm.
And
interesting.
You can can just picture this kind of magician, this female magician, this sorceress sitting on a three-legged stool of time.
Mm-hmm.
And what would that be? I see it as the past, the present, and the future.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, there's all sorts of things any reader can read into it. But it's little things like that. Huh. Taking a word that is literally one thing in another language, but making it work in a better context in your own.
Yeah. That's interesting, that word, because I know actually the word tripod is used in classical text, in translating classical text into English. So-and-so will arrive at a sacred site and erect a tripod, and I've often wondered what the devil that meant, because in English it doesn't really make a lot of referential sense.
Right, certainly in modern English. I mean, we have a very specific idea of what a tripod is. It's like it's something you put a camera on when you're going to take a picture, and we see it that way. And so you're probably right that it's had many meanings through time.
We'll have to delve into that more.
Yes. But for the time
quest
being,
for the tripod.
Right. For the time being, this sorceress is sitting on a three-legged stool, not on a tripod.
That makes a very good image. Much better in English, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, it was good. And then there was another poem that has something that makes you stop and think. It's called The Head in the Desert. It's one of the last poems in the book. And I've had a debate with some poet I know in particular on the first line. And the way I've translated it is, I've stuck pretty much to the original German, "On the desert of daily death, I built me your head." Hmm. And of course, the question is, I built me your head, or I built your head?
Your head, yes.
And
what's the German?
It's, you can even hear it, I think, if I read it well enough.
Okay.
Ich baute mir dein Haupt über der Wüste des taglichen Todes. And he said, ich baute mir, I built me, your head, dein Haupt.
Right.
Über der Wüste, over the desert, des täglichen Todes, of daily death.
Yes.
And but he uses that. So I thought to me that sounded biblical.
Uh-huh.
And I got out my Lutheran Bible, and I got out the Bible that my grandfather gave me when I was 6 years old that has a wonderful index in the back.
Uh-huh.
And I looked up the expression, I built me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to find it, and I'm sorry my memory is lost. I can't quote chapter and verse at the moment, but it's beautiful in the King James Version, as I built me houses, I built me this, I built me that. And Luther says exactly the German that Gall writes.
So, yeah, Gall was echoing. That's another Old Testament echo.
Uh-huh. That's so I'm using those things at the moment, just as I did with the Job, in the Job piece. So that I think I like the idea that this man who is very schooled in literature and his own heritage of the Old Testament, that he is harking back to that in these poems that are very important to him and coming from a very deep place inside of him as he's dying. So for
this would have been probably some of the earliest formal language that he would have learned as a child.
I'm sure it was.
Yeah. Old Testament. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And he did a lot of reading and got involved into the Kabbalah and did a lot of research and reading, and I'm sure talking with friends and other people about it. And I hear these echoes in some of these poems, certainly not in all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But when I do hear that echo, it's something that I, as a translator into English, want to preserve so that an American reader can say, I built me your head.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of language is that?
Yeah.
And for me, it does harken back there. For others, it doesn't. Some people just think, well, it doesn't sound like good English, but I don't know how to handle that. What would you do?
I think yours is a good choice. I mean, you do want to preserve, if there's an echo, an intended echo in the original, an intended resonance, then, part of the tough job of translating is preserving those resonances.
That's right. That's the way I see it. And I was really quite excited to see that Luther had used that very ich baute mir, so
expression.
On.
Expression, right.
And that the Lutheran Bible, of course, is the basic translation used to this day. It was a brilliant piece of work.
I'm sure, right. Well, Nan, thanks so much for coming in today and sharing your work with Yvonne Gall.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be here.
Wow. We'll do some more. This is WPVM 103.5, the progressive voice of the mountains. You're tuned to Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. And today we've been listening to an interview with translator Nan Watkins, part of which was featured on Wordplay in December of last year, when, of course, it was a 30-minute show. Be sure to check naturespoetry.blogspot.com for more information about today's show.